This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Take a moment to listen to the sound of one of the hottest technologies of the year. That's a 3D printer, a small home version by Solidoodle. As we begin to look back on the year 2013, 3D printing stands out as one of the technologies making headlines and changing the way we live. After the Boston Marathon bombing, we saw stories about families using 3D printers, machines that print plastic instead of ink, to fabricate customized prosthetics for far less money than commercially available ones. A few months later, researchers at Princeton University and Johns Hopkins announced that they had printed a bionic human ear, a combination of electronics, a printed skeleton, and cultured human cartilage. 3D printing also reared its head in the debate over gun control, morphing the traditional question of how to regulate gun sales into one of how to police gun production, when anyone can buy a 3D printer and download gun designs from the internet. So with all these stories in mind today, we're talking about 3D printing, the promise as well as the perils and pitfalls of this potentially revolutionary technology. We have three experts with us to cover the topic. The first two are Dr. Hod Lipson and Melba Kerman. Dr. Hod Lipson is an associate professor at Cornell University, where he investigates what he considers to be, quote, the grand challenges of engineering, whether we can design and make machines that can, in turn, design and make other machines. Melba Kerman is an author and independent technology analyst specializing in innovation and emerging technologies. Together, Melba Kerman and Hod Lipson are the authors of Fabricated, the New World of 3D Printing. They join us now from a studio at Cornell University. Welcome to both of you.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks, Heather. Pleasure to be here.
And here in our Woods Hole studio with me is Chris Connors. Connors is an engineering and creativity educator currently teaching in the Art, Design, and Technology Department at Martha's Vineyard Regional High School. He's a makerspace guru on the board of directors of the Cape Cod Makers and has been a contributor to Make magazine. Chris, welcome.
Good morning.
Now, Hod or Melba, in your book Fabricated, you lay out very early on this futuristic, I don't know if it's science fiction really or not, but this futuristic scenario, maybe around the end of this century, where a typical day basically starts, ends, and everything in between involves 3D printers. So could you walk us through what you think a day will be like in a couple of generations and how 3D printers will be involved in our lives?
Absolutely. So just as a little bit of a background on that first chapter, we actually went back and forth several times on that when we were writing the book of, should we keep it? Nah. Okay, let's put it back in. But what we envisioned with that was that it was a kickoff chapter that we hoped would get the reader's attention. And the way we wrote that was that we imagined several decades in the future that would be a typical day in the life after 3D printing technologies have become a regular home and business, and actually a technology that's ubiquitous. So the day begins with a person waking up, and the first thing they do is they smell the scent of freshly printed blueberry muffins coming from the kitchen. And this is their food printer, which is receiving wireless streams of data that is registering that morning's blood sugar levels and compiling that data into some other metrics that it has, calorie counts, recent activity levels, and 3D printing that person their perfect blueberry breakfast muffins calibrated exactly for them.
I mean, for Star Trek fan, this all sounds very, you know, Captain Kirk.
Likely.
Earl Grey, black, you know, make it so. Why would we want to print food? Why is cooking it not good enough?
Well, cooking is very good. I hope it sticks around. But the beauty of 3D printed food is that it's a convergence. And when you think about the big trends that are coming out in biometrics and people who are tracking their you know, blood sugar, the paces they took that day, the calories burned, and the fact that these devices are getting smaller, cheaper, and available for home use. And there's also even iPhone apps where people measure what their bodies are doing. So it's a small step from there to wirelessly stream all that data to a hypothetical food printer that then prints you out the perfect meal. So that's what's great about this concept.
Okay, so breakfast printed by the food printer in the kitchen. What's next?
So after that, we started looking at a few different aspects of daily life that might be affected by 3D printing, everything from a large-scale construction project that's happening across the street, where instead of dozens of workers building a house, you have basically a large unfolding 3D printer that deposits concrete, scans the area, adjusts, and prints a sort of arbitrarily shaped, complex building right there and then. We move on to talk about the use of 3D printing in safety, in mining, to print spare parts. We talk a little bit about bioprinting and the sort of regulatory issues around people printing things they shouldn't be printing or should be printing, and how the medical establishment is dealing with it. And we talk also, we sort of end with this sort of scene in the at-home printing where a mother is printing a toothbrush for her child just because the child sort of lost his toothbrush somewhere. And the child, you know, has to wait 15 minutes until the toothbrush is ready, until his custom toothbrush is printed. And he can't believe that once upon a time, a couple of decades ago, you used to have to wait maybe a whole day until the toothbrush that you ordered was shipped. So that's sort of a glimpse, I think, of the future. There's lots of other examples, but we try to see how it affects daily life. It's not just a technology that's in the back room of big industries or technology that hobbyists and makers use, but really everybody will be affected by it one way or another.
And you think this is a realistic scenario for what, a few decades from now?
I think even sooner than that. Really, everything that we wrote about is already happening. There's no new technology involved in any of these ideas. It's more of a question of whether the business models are there, whether it will take root financially, commercially. But the technology is already here and can do all of these things.
Now, Chris Connors, you're kind of living this to some degree. You do have access to 3D printers in your everyday life. And in fact, when you walked into the studio this morning, you said, oh, well, I was away from my printers from the weekend, so I don't have a lot of things to show you. But you reached into your pocket and pulled out
the
little
hand
object.
Of Keith Ozar.
Not the actual hand. It's about a two and a half inch long, I guess, replica plastic hand.
It's a scan of a person's hand giving the okay sign.
And so you are living essentially this futuristic scenario already. I mean, you were also talking about the fact that instead of, it wasn't your toothbrush, it was a clip for a cell phone to put it on your bike handles. Instead of going and paying $25 or $30 for that, you just print it for yourself. I mean, do you think this is the way that things are going in two or three decades? Is everybody just going to be printing everything for themselves?
I think many people will. Initially, it'll be the early adopters and the people who want to be on the edge of it. I have actually printed a spoon so that I could eat my breakfast in a hotel room because I didn't want to go down to the front desk and ask for a spoon. But I actually designed it, and then I printed it, and then I went to bed, and in the morning I woke up and ate my breakfast with my 3D printed
spoon.
So
it did take a little bit of forethought. This wasn't a 2-minute process. It probably would have been actually faster to walk down and get the spoon.
Oh, it totally would have been faster, but I wanted
but it was
to
cooler
prove a point.
To print your own spoon.
It's a good story.
Now, Had, you describe, talk about the 21st century being about bringing the virtual world and the real world or the physical world into sync, and that 3D printing is essentially the mechanism for that. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, there's, we've seen a lot of things being scanned and moved from physical to virtual in the last century, in the last decade or two. Books are being scanned. Music is recorded. A lot of things have become virtual. What this technology does is connects in the other direction. So things that are virtual can now become physical. You have, crazy shapes and geometries and items can now suddenly become physical. It's an avenue for them to go from the virtual to the physical. And I think that closing the loop that way will really allow a lot of interesting things to happen. It was a one-way street up to now, and now it's a two-way street, and that opens up a lot of possibilities.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Chris Connors, Melba Kerman, and Had Lipson about 3D printing, the promise and pitfalls of this potentially revolutionary technology. We also want to hear from you. If you could print anything, what would it be? And if you're already using 3D printing, tell us how. Our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Or you can find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or Twitter. I'd like to ask each of you to describe your first encounter or when you first became aware of 3D printing. And Chris, I'll start with you.
Originally, one of the ways that I got into some of these emerging technologies was at the Boston Fab Lab. It's housed in the South End Technology Center, and lots of people would come in there and would be working with laser cutters and vinyl cutters and mills and using computer-controlled tools to cut things for the most part. And people would come in and ask, do you have a 3D printer or something that would make additive parts?
So actually making things instead of cutting them away.
Yeah. And we didn't have one. And then a few years ago, some of the patents around 3D printing sort of became into the public domain. And some people that I knew started working on the MakerBot project, and they created a kit printer. And so I got to sort of watch that through their postings, and other friends were getting the kits and building them and turning them into 3D printing.
So this is the MakerBot kit is literally a kit where you can make your own.
The original 3D, one yeah. was. It was called the MakerBot Cupcake, and a few friends of mine got those. Jimmy Rogers and Becky Stern, they got them, and they were enjoying working with them and having lots of fun with them. And that was something that I was watching other people do. And then when the kit really started to take off, I decided that I had to get in on that revolution and try it out. And so I bought one just before the tax year ended and have had it in my classroom for a couple of years. I think that might have been 2009. And so I've had it in my classroom for a few years and teaching kids how to design their own parts and print their own parts and helping them to bring their ideas onto this side of the computer screen.
Right, that kind of connection between virtual and physical we were just talking about. Melba Kerman, I wonder how you first got introduced to the technology.
So when you asked me that, I started thinking back, digging into my mind, and I think actually the first time I ever heard about 3D printing was actually about 10 years ago, when back then I was out in Seattle, and I was a product manager for Windows Server at Microsoft. And I remember one of my colleagues, his specialty was selling into what we called the manufacturing vertical. So he was trying to market Windows servers to these manufacturing companies, and he would go out on these trips, visit these manufacturing firms, and he came back and told us about this thing that he saw that was this 3D printer. And then we had the sort of usual circular who's on first type discussions about, wait, did you say 3D printer? But it's a printer. And for those of us at the time who are heavily into software, we were very familiar with 2D printing and printing paper and printer drivers and the whole culture and ecosystem that exists around paper printers. And so we would have these endless discussions of, no, it's 3D. It actually prints stuff. And there's this whole industry out there. And so I think that was actually the first time. And then 4 years ago, I started really thinking about this much more intensely and learning about it for real, not just hearing about it.
So that sounds kind of like the mental shift that basically all of us are going to have to go through. We are all familiar with paper printers at this point. You've just maybe done it a little earlier and more quickly than the rest of society.
Yes, and it's also given me that sensitivity that when I hear people now explaining 3D printing in the context of printing paper, I always cringe, and because I know that there's going to be a long back and forth until it's finally sorted out that this printing, as it's called, is actually really called additive manufacturing, which is the technical term, but is in a way much more descriptive. And it has nothing to do with paper, nothing to do with inkjets, nothing to do with the printer on your desk.
Well, we will get into that actual process because, yes, I went through that same kind of process of trying to figure out exactly what 3D printing looks like when you use that printing analogy in your brain. So we'll come back to that. But Hodlibson, your first encounter with 3D printing, I believe, goes back further than either of the other two that we've heard now.
Right. So I first heard about it in 87 when I was taking my engineering class on manufacturing. And that was back in Israel. And one of the first 3D printing companies, Cubital, one of the salespersons came in. And that company is now defunct. But back then it was selling a huge 3D printer. It came into the class, burst in through the door with a 3D printed part and turned the crank. It had moving gears and ratchets inside, and it made these interesting sounds. And it was a mind-blowing experience. That was, again, back in 87. The idea that you can 3D print a plastic object was just impossible. And even CAD, computer-aided design, was fairly new at the time. And so the idea that you can go from sort of a computer model into a 3D object without actually carving out any material but just printing it was amazing. So he just walked in, turned this thing. We later learned that he was actually an invited guest speaker to that class. But he was a good showman. And startled all of us, and I won't forget that moment. To me, it was immediately obvious that at once, all of conventional manufacturing seemed obsolete. This is going to be the future. And it took a lot longer than that salesperson predicted. He was talking about, within a few years, but we are here now, maybe two, almost three decades later. But it's finally happening. It will probably take a few more decades, but I still think it's as revolutionary as it seemed to be back then.
All right. We're talking this hour about the promise and pitfalls of 3D printing technology. More after a short break.
Dan Waters of West Tisbury on the Linotype machine.
Large and black and full of gears. And we like this old machine because it's like having a pet dinosaur. It looks like something that somebody would invent in a dream. They say that Otmar Mergenthaler, who invented this machine, went crazy.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.
There's a first time for everything. First dates, first jobs, your first driveway moment with public radio. Support WCAI with a gift in any amount for the first time, or just the first time in a while, and you'll be counted in our 4 for Feb challenge. 400 gifts between now and the end of the year, and February will go fundraiser-free on WCAI. Be a part of it. Call 855-469-9224.
Next time on The World, we're in Chicago for the anniversary of the death of a legendary crime boss. No, it's not Al Capone. It's Pablo Escobar, killed on December 2nd, 20 years ago. Colombian immigrants in Chicago can't forget the day, and they have very mixed feelings about how the drug lord is celebrated now. Remembering Pablo Escobar in the land of Al Capone on The World.
Tonight at 8 on the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
Welcome back to Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests this hour are Melba Kerman and Dr. Hodlibson, authors of Fabricated, The New World of 3D Printing. Also with me is creativity and engineering educator Chris Connors. And of course, we want to hear from you. If you're printing with 3D printers, how are you using it? And if you would like to be, how would you like to use a 3D printer? Let your imagination run wild. Give us a call. Our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Be sure to press 5 when you call to reach us here in the studio. Or you can email us at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Now, let's explain this process a little bit, because as we were saying before the break, it is not completely intuitive. Chris Connors, can you just explain a little bit? We call it 3D printing, I guess, in the broader layman's terms, but additive manufacturing. How does this actually work? What does it look like when you're printing something?
Well, I think you've seen additive manufacturing on the beach.
Really?
With your kids?
Well, okay, yes, making sandcastles.
That's additive manufacturing. So they scoop up a couple of hands of goopy, wet sand, and they dribble it over a certain place, and then they move over and they dribble it over another place. They dribble it over another place, and then they got to go get another handful of sand, and they keep dribbling and dribbling until eventually they have a drip castle. That's
okay.
3D printing without the robot.
Well, one
or
thing
the
that
plastic.
I was saying, one
or
thing,
the computer.
Without any of that technology. One of the things that a 3D printer can do that my kids definitely can't do on the beach, at least additively, is to make something hollow. So they can make a big mound of sand and then dig out a tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes. But how do you do that with 3D printing? I mean, you're essentially printing things, as you were just describing, printing something in layers, dribbling material in layers. How do you put a top on that? How do you create a layer that's bigger than what's underneath it?
So with the software that designs the movements of the machine does is it can specify how much solid is inside the shape. So in the case of this hand here, in the middle, there's a whole bunch of honeycomb shapes that give a little bit of structure to it without a whole lot of weight and without a whole lot of excess material.
So in fact, that hand that looks like a solid hand is hollow inside.
Semi-hollow.
Or mostly
probably
hollow.
At least semi-hollow.
Hmm. Now, Hodlibson, I know there are different kinds of printers. Can you describe the two different classes of 3D printers and what distinguishes them?
Well, there's generally printers that deposit material, like the sandcastle analogy that we just heard, and they can be depositing plastic, they can be depositing metals, they can be depositing lots of different materials in that sort of process. And that we call that selective deposition because they deposit material selectively in different places according to the shape. The other type starts off with sort of a powder. A powder bed, and then he uses a laser or some other energy source to solidify the powder and make it a solid. So it selectively traces out a cross-section of the object with a laser and makes it solid. Then it sprinkles another layer of powder, flattens it out, and solidifies that layer, sprinkles another layer of powder, and so forth. So it goes up layer by layer that way. And what you end up in the end is an object that's sort of buried in powder. And then that might answer your previous question also. The overhangs are supported by powder in the previous layer. So you sort of pull it out, dust it off, and you have your piece.
So you actually describe a very extreme version of that last process in the book. And while we're talking about beaches and sand, there's apparently a person who has a solar-powered 3D printer that instead of using a laser uses a magnifying glass to harness the sun's power and uses desert sand as that powder, if you will, to then manufacture glass items out in the middle of the desert. Can you talk a little bit about that project? It's really quite amazing.
So that's actually called sand sintering. And for those of you who have ever played with a magnifying glass on a sunny day and you've burned patterns, say, into your sidewalk or your sandals, that's essentially what this young man is doing. His name is Marcus, and I'm forgetting his last name here for a second. But what he did is he set up this concept that is extraordinarily green type of manufacturing. And so he rigged up a gigantic magnifying glass, a frame, and attached a laptop to it and took it out to the desert. And what he did is he aimed the magnifying glass at a bed of sand guided by the computer, and he started printing or sintering sand into these very crude silicon bowls, shapes, and things like that. Because when you think about what glass is, it's essentially melted sand, you know, in one form or another. And so this is an example of the cleanest type of manufacturing you will ever see, because not only was he using solar power, he was using material that was readily available in the environment. And then when he was done with this experiment, he could just toss these glass bowls, glass objects, back into the sand. And in a couple decades or so, the objects would be ground right back into sand where they started.
Amazing.
This is called sand sintering, yeah.
Amazing. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. Remember to press 5 when you give us a call. Sam is calling from Oak Bluffs.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah, great. Great program. 3D printing is really interesting to me. I wonder if you were trying to make, say, a mock-up of a sculpture, how you could use 3D printing to do that. You might create a small model, which you would then build larger by different technology, by hand perhaps. I'm wondering how hard the interface of the printer is to use. You need to draw this sculpture out and create it in three dimensions, and that would seem to be the difficult thing.
Chris Connors, you've got students, high school students, doing this. How difficult is it to actually create one of the design files that the printer needs to work from?
Well, I think what Sam's describing is he wants to make a physical object that he then wants to bring into the computer and then make through 3D printing, maybe make multiples or change the scale or something like that.
Not really.
Or if we were, I think he was talking about making a small, essentially a prototype that he could make then a larger sculpture.
Is that accurate?
Yes.
So I think the process that you'd probably want to get familiar with is 3D scanning. And there's a whole bunch of new ideas going on in 3D scanning where people a few years ago started working with like the Microsoft Kinect, and they'd tap into the data that was coming from the cameras from that game device and bring it into the computer and then be able to scan objects. You can also do it with a series of photographs with your camera on your phone. Just take a whole bunch of pictures of it and then bring it into some software, and then it stitches it together and finds where the object is. There are a number of other ways of doing it. In the beginnings of a technology, everything is all kind of haphazard and not streamlined. You have to figure out exactly how to do it kind of the first time. Now, and eventually it gets easier as the systems and processes get more refined.
Now, Sam, I have a question for you. If you were going to use a 3D printer to make a prototype, why wouldn't you just use a 3D printer to make the sculpture?
Well, I was thinking that I would prefer to actually do it by hand, and that it would be small. I would be making a small prototype to see what it looks like, and then I'd want to make quite a large thing, and I couldn't afford a large 3D printer. And then just one last question, Chris. So when will you be teaching a course in this at Martha's Vineyard?
If you were in high school, you could sign up for it right now.
All right.
But I am taking a look at offering some programs for adults in the community. What materials are you interested in working with or that you currently are familiar with that you have the skills in?
Well, actually, it's a totally new idea for me, but it could be anything. It could be plywood. I was thinking of a sculpture of sails, large sails, and I was actually thinking of doing them, and I'm mocking them up in paper and cardboard right now, and then I was thinking of doing them in plywood or, you know, as a big mock-up, and then, I don't know, just experimenting with different kinds of materials. I'm not a sculptor. I'm a photographer, and I'm just dabbling and having fun with it.
Well, thanks for giving us a call, Sam, and giving us a taste of what artists are thinking about with regard to 3D printing. You can give us a call at 866-999-4626. Press 5 when you do call. Joel's on the line from Brewster. What's on your mind, Joel?
Well, I have a question about what used to be called inkjets, I guess. Whatever it is, it's laying down the ink. And my question is, can you have more than one kind depositing more than one material at a time? And what I'm thinking of is like super thin ferro cement, where you mentioned already building things out of cement. And if you had part of the machine laying down the cement, could you have another part laying down fine steel reinforcing, or maybe even better, a spider web type of polymer that'd be super strong and super light, but give you super thin and super strong ferro cement, so to speak.
Yeah, Hod-Lipson, I mean, one of the strengths, as I understand it, of 3D printing or additive manufacturing is this part that you can blend materials, do different types of materials all in one manufacturing process. Is that right?
That's right. That's actually that's a perfect example of where things are going. Right now, most 3D printers can only work with one material. Most of the consumer printers work only with plastic. But commercial printers can work with a huge range of materials, from glass to even wood-like material and metal and stainless steel and titanium. But the newer printers, and I think this is where the future is, can combine multiple materials in the same print. So just as the caller said, you can combine, let's say, concrete and steel in one print. That is not, I think, that specific combination is not available today because the material properties are too different to be combined at this point. But you can definitely combine different types of plastic, hard and soft plastic in one print. We've printed soft metals and plastic in the same print to make conductive wires in the lab. It's not just about combining raw materials to create the hybrid structure, but it's really about creating new kinds of material by combining materials in new ways, just like you can create new shades of colors by combining only three prime colors. You can create entirely new kinds of materials, new material properties by combining simple existing materials in new ways and new patterns. And I think that's a very exciting path forward, and which hasn't been explored yet, but it's definitely in the future.
Hmm. Melba Kerman, I wonder if you could explain, perhaps, if we understand why 3D technology is kind of booming now. You know, this technology is a few decades old. We're thinking probably it's going to take a few more decades for it to really take hold, but we have been hearing all of these stories about things like being able to print a bionic ear with both the electronic circuits and the plastics all in one, coming from one machine. What is it that's going on now that's making this technology really blossom?
So I would say it's comes back to the convergence. And so when you look back historically and you look at periods where a technology has stepped forward and really suddenly started to become useful, it's rarely that technology did that all by itself. It's sort of like in showbiz when people become an overnight success and they've actually been at it for decades. But in the case of 3D printing, it's actually not just the 3D printer alone. And in fact, a 3D printer by itself is essentially fairly useless. What makes a 3D printer useful is actually the software that surrounds it, and including also medical imaging as well, has vastly and dramatically improved. So the reason we're seeing a big increase in interest in 3D printing is that finally there's been this convergence of essential technology, including design software, has finally gotten cheap enough that regular people can afford it, and some of it's even free. Computing power has also gotten powerful enough to actually make digital models of things. And then, not to be forgotten, we have optical scanning technologies. Carl earlier mentioned the Microsoft Kinect, which is actually becoming a pretty darn good home scanner. And then we also have the fact that hardware costs are dropping. So just like your cell phone has gotten a lot cheaper and smaller and better than it was a decade ago, the same thing is going on for 3D printers.
All right. We are getting a lot of phone calls here this morning. Our number is 866-999-4626. Press 5 when you call. Perry is calling from Woods Hole. You're on the line, Perry.
Yes, hi. My curiosity is, first, the technology has existed for quite a while as far as 3D scanning and whatnot. Point being, I recently lost a few teeth, and I was looking up 3D printing for having those done up, and I found out that the acrylics required for this, I believe in some way, are medically or FDA protected because it's related to your body. Are those copyrights or patent rights that have to be overcome so people can do it personally?
That's a great question. And Melba Kerman, there are a lot of regulatory issues, obviously, when we get into people being able to print, whether it's medical devices or, as we heard during the gun control debate earlier this year, whether or not people could print their own guns. There are obviously a lot of regulatory issues having to do with this new technology. Where do we stand on that?
So it's important to keep in mind that when it comes to regulatory issues and legal issues, there's a whole tangle. There's a whole bunch of different categories. And so what Perry was referring to, the first one is FDA approval. And so FDA approval has nothing to do with patents and copyrights. It's actually just the FDA saying, yes, this particular plastic is safe to put inside a human body. And the first answer to that is actually the FDA has indeed approved certain types of printed polymers for use inside the human body. But the other types of regulatory issues, and the way I divide them, I guess, after you get past FDA approval issues, is there are consumer safety issues, there are intellectual property issues, and then there's actual crime. And so when we look at 3D printers, just like any platform technology, say computers, automobiles, it can be used for good, it can be used for bad, and then there's a whole lot of room in the middle where good people do things that have accidental or inadvertent side effects. And so when we look at intellectual property, consumer safety, and crime, we see that a 3D printer actually does have a disruptive effect on all three of those arenas.
We'll talk more about that after a short break. Stay with us.
Another Science Minute.
I'm a pack rat.
Entomologist Rich Pollack from the Harvard School of Public Health on his louse comb collection.
So these are louse combs here, which are meant for killing lice. Some of these plastic combs, you can see the teeth are so flexible. I suppose this might, if you were to run this through your hair, it might remove a few lice, probably no louse eggs. These teeth are just so flexible, they move right out of the way. So I think this is probably not worth the plastic it was made from. Here's a nifty one with two rows of metal teeth. Here's an old one with bamboo teeth, probably used more than 100 years ago. This goes on and on. Then there are these devices that look like pliers. You place into the hair, and then you pull them through, and sometimes you pull off. As I just did, I just removed a few hairs from my head. Imagine if a product today came with a guarantee. This is the $1,000 guaranteed Contento. A specific for head lice, body lice, crab lice, has an agreeable odor, is pleasant to use. I've been known to go on eBay and buy things that I can't imagine there's actually a bidding war. There's somebody else crazy enough to bid against them.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking today about the promise and pitfalls of 3D printing with my guests Melba Kerman, Dr. Hod Lipson, and Chris Connors. Now, before the break, Melba, you were talking about the regulatory issues and how disruptive how this is a disruptive technology in terms of the regulatory landscape. This is also a very disruptive technology when it comes to our traditional manufacturing infrastructure. Has there been any pushback from the manufacturing industry that perhaps feel threatened by the idea that manufacturing could suddenly be done by everybody everywhere?
So it's actually not the manufacturing industry that's concerned about this. Right now, the biggest areas of concern that I've seen actually have been from the perspective of safety, and in particular the 3D printed gun parts that have gotten all kinds of different people very confused and upset. But the traditional mass manufacturers actually are not concerned about consumer printing yet at all, and in part because mass manufacturers have used 3D printers to speed along the manufacturing process now for decades, and also consumer printing has not yet reached a scale where it's posing a serious threat to anybody. With that said, we're going to see some consumer safety issues with very well-intended things that regular people are selling to regular people. And I call this C2C manufacturing or consumer-to-consumer manufacturing. So this is, again, not going to be terrorists. It's not going to be criminals. It's going to be people like me and you who are designing, buying, and selling 3D printed objects to one another. And they just haven't been tested for safety. The materials might not be safe. The structure of, say, a bicycle helmet that I buy from you that's 3D printed might actually shatter on impact. And so the most concern, especially from the feds, has actually been from the 3D printed gun parts, not yet people making things for other people.
Now, in terms of the pros and cons of 3D printing as a new manufacturing way of life, modus operandi, I guess, there are the energy, resource, and environmental concerns. And I think 3D printing, the promise of the technology is perhaps that it could be a very green and efficient way of doing things. That has been the hope and what proponents of the technology have said. But in reality, at least at this point, I've also seen analyses saying we're not really living up to the promise at this point. 3D printing is probably actually more wasteful than traditional manufacturing. Is it going to be possible for 3D printing to realize that promise and to actually become a greener way of making things?
I think it's indeed a double-edged sword. If you look at 3D printing today, it is in plastic, for example, it's about 10 to 20 times more energy hungry than, let's say, injection molding per kilogram of part printed. So it's very, very expensive in energy. It also produces more waste than injection molding. With metal, it also consumes much more energy. It doesn't produce as much waste, but it's definitely not as efficient in terms of energy. Where the big savings of 3D printing are sort of indirect. One of them is the fact that you can print only what you need when you need it. You can print it where you need it, reducing supply chain transportation distribution networks, which account for a lot of the environmental impact of most products. And finally, and I think most importantly, you can make much more optimized parts. We see, for example, parts of an aircraft that are produced in stainless steel. They cost more energy to produce, but they end up being much lighter and stronger than the original parts. And therefore, the aircraft is lighter, consumes less fuel, has a smaller environmental impact. So these are indirect effects, but they far outweigh, they could outweigh, the actual cost of production, which is actually higher with 3D printers.
I mean, in your book, Fabricated, you basically go through 10 principles of 3D printing as a way of manufacturing. And if you kind of put it all together, what you get is a manufacturing infrastructure that is lower throughput, faster design, higher profit margins, very different than the whole mass production system that we currently have in place. And what kind of occurred to me in reading that description is wondering whether 3D printing could become part of perhaps a more sustainable economy, one that is not based so much on mass production and consumerism, a more on-demand and slightly smaller scale economy with a different kind of growth. Is 3D printing part of that?
I think it really turns around and upsets a lot of conventional thinking about manufacturing. I don't know if we will consume less because of 3D printing. In fact, it might go the other way around, that we'll learn to consume more. We'll be more impatient about things. We'll want them right immediately when we need them and so forth. But I think we might be able to be more efficient about production. In other words, we might make only what we need when we need it, where we need it. We might be able to make things that are more customized and efficient to their purpose. And so it's a little bit it's a departure from conventional thinking. But it's important to remember right now, 3D printing is about a 0.1% of conventional manufacturing. And while it's growing rapidly at maybe 25% to 30% per year, it's really a very, very small fraction of conventional manufacturing. It's more about really rethinking new business models, new ways of taking advantage of this technology rather than sort of replacing conventional manufacturing and just doing away with mass production. It's really about thinking of new ways to use it to take advantage of what we call mass customization.
Chris Connors, are we seeing small-scale manufacturing using 3D printers springing up around the Cape and Islands and around our own region?
There's definitely some. There's definitely interest. I've met a few people on the Cape that have their own 3D printers, and lots of people are interested in it.
Now, you also use 3D printing. As you said, you have one in your classroom at Martha's Vineyard Regional High School.
Two.
Use it in education. I believe Mashpee Tech is also starting to use 3D printing.
They're doing great things over in Mashpee.
I wonder how different the student experience. What is it that you want your students to get out of the experience, and how different is it to manufacture or make something with a 3D printer versus making something really with your own two hands? Do you get something different out of that experience educationally?
I think both skills are valid. And with the 3D printer, there are things that you can make that have great precision. And you can get something that has, a tenth of an inch or, you know, hundredth of an inch of precision that will really exactly fit with another part. So, for example, a student wanted a stand for his cell phone, and so he designed it and printed it. And he had to go through a couple of processes, iterative processes, to get it the way he wanted it. But eventually he got the stand that he wanted.
I mean, and this goes back to the question from a caller earlier. What skills do you need? What level of mathematics, of engineering, of computer programming do you actually need to be able to manufacture something like a cell phone stand for yourself?
I think, like the earlier caller, I think it was Sam, said, I have this idea of this thing that I want. That's usually enough to get started.
Well, and I would assume groups like Cape Cod Makers, these public groups, provide a venue perhaps where people could come in and say, I have an idea. Can you help me make this reality?
Groups like Cape Cod Makers help bring together people who are interested in exploring these ideas. They aren't necessarily a place that is going to be a service where you can bring your idea and somebody else is going to do it for you. It's a place where you can meet other people who are similarly curious and maybe not exactly curious in your project, but might be able to help you find the right resources and move along.
Now, I posed this question to our listeners and want to pose it to each of you. If you could print anything with a 3D printer, what would it be and why? Melba Kerman, I'll start with you.
So for me, it would actually change day to day, depending on what sort of dilemma I was facing. But I remember a few months ago, we renovated our kitchen, and a day did not go by that I was not wishing to myself, oh, I wish I could just 3D print that stupid part or that nail or that knob or that, you know, whatever. So I think that's, in terms of practical stuff, it changes depending on what sort of dilemma I'm facing at the time. In terms of big picture, you know, blue sky, that's a great question. I think right now I would probably print maybe some sort of fantastic bicycle that's all in one piece, that's built just for my height and weight, and that's extraordinarily aerodynamic.
Is that something that's within the realm of possibility?
The frame is, but we're not yet at the point where we can actually print out the metal chain and the rubber tires and the different wires and stuff. But we'll get there.
Now, you mentioned wanting to basically print your way out of any dilemma. And Chris Connors, from the perspective of kind of the makers movement, do it yourself. Often when you are doing it yourself, one of the challenges and sometimes the fun and the learning opportunity is in the fact that you don't have everything right at your fingertips and you've got to figure out how to make it work with what you've got. Does this technology eliminate some of that challenge, perhaps diminish some of that experience and that mental challenge?
It provides a lens through which you see various problems. I guess the old adage of if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If you have a 3D printer, you seem to find a lot of things that need to be 3D printed.
Okay, so if you could print anything, what would it be?
One thing that I have, I'm actually surprised that I haven't made a better version of it yet. I've made a couple passes at it, but a good bracket that will hold my cell phone on the dashboard of my car so that I can have like a map program up on the dashboard in an easy place and my phone won't be all sliding around the dashboard.
I mean, it's amazing that that doesn't actually already exist.
Oh,
you would
I'm
think
sure
that that's something
does.
That everybody wants.
I'm just a little...
you haven't
lazy
found the absolute
on getting
perfect
that
one.
Done, yes.
But then that I mean that really gets at the heart of what 3D printing is all about, is this ultimate customization as opposed to mass production, that you haven't found the one that perfectly suits you, and that's what 3D printing could do for you.
And if I don't find the one existing already that somebody else has made, then I know that I can make it myself. I just haven't gotten around to it, I suppose.
Hod Lipson, if you could print anything in the world, what would it be?
So first I have to ask if you will allow me to describe two things, not just one.
Oh, sure.
Two things.
Well, we've only got a few minutes, but yes, go for it.
So one thing that we've actually been working on quite intensively in the lab, I would like to print a robot, complete robot, that would walk out of the printer, batteries included. Mm-hmm. And I think that sort of is a milestone that eventually we'll get to, but it involves basically not just printing passive parts, as often we print today, but actually printing integrated systems with wires, electronics, batteries, you know, everything in them. And I think, you know, when we can do that, we're really it will make everything that all the 3D printing today look pale in contrast to what we can do when we can print all of these things together. The other thing that I would like to print, also we're working on that, is a sort of a pastry with all kinds of different, you know, in chocolate on the inside. And, you know, I can go on forever describing all
the intricate
complexities in there, something that you couldn't buy anywhere, you couldn't make. Even a skilled pastry chef couldn't make something like that. And I think that's all within reach.
Hmm. The brave new world of 3D printing. Now, Chris Connors, we've got just about a minute here. I know we've got the Cape Cod Makers Faire that you're helping organize this spring. Will that be an opportunity for folks to learn more about 3D printing?
Indeed. And it would be a lot of fun if some people were interested in the solar sintering, the sand sintering project. That, I think, would be a great project as well. I can't say that I've started on it, but if anybody's interested in it, I'd like to help with that project.
You certainly have sand around.
Yeah.
All right. Chris Connors, a creativity and engineering educator on Martha's Vineyard. Thank you. Melba Kerman, Dr. Hod Lipson, together the authors of Fabricated, The New World of 3D Printing. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks all for listening. Until next week, this is Living Lab on the Point. Stay in touch with Living Lab Radio every day on Facebook and Twitter. And of course, you can find links to more information about 3D printing on our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Heather Goldstone.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.